When the world ended, you lost everything. You survived because you had each other. Now, one of you has been infected. In your final days together, what will you say? Hey, it's Elliot from the My First Dungeon team, and I'm excited to tell you about my next game, The Time We Have, A Conversation Between Brothers, a tragic zombie storytelling game headed to BackerKit on October 29th. This game is played on opposite sides of a closed door with a custom deck of cards that will guide you through a story about what it means to be a brother in the final days before one of you turns. To make this game a reality, we need your help to give us the best possible launch on day one. So please head to bit.ly/thetimewehave and pre-save the campaign so you can be notified as soon as we launch. That's bit.ly/thetimewehave. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Alex Roberts. Alex is an award-winning game designer of a number of phenomenal TTRPGs, including StarCross and For the Queen, which has recently had a second edition release by Critical Role's publishing arm, Darrington Press. Alex Roberts,
welcome to the table.
Welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me. Hi.
Oh, thanks so much for being here. We've been looking forward to this one for a while. You've been on our list since we first started the show.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you. That's so flattering.
We are big StarCrossed and For the Queen fans around here.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, Alex, we always love to kind of set the goal for the conversation up top, kind of talk through what our hopes and dreams for the through line of this conversation are. And today, what we really want to talk to you about is out-of-box play, out-of-box game design, because we think like what you are best known for is two incredible examples of this kind of game, StarCross and For the Queen. And so that we hope by the end of this conversation, any game designer listening can take lessons away from your work about how to get new players into TTRPGs. And Brian really loves to talk about on this show activation energy and how like that's a big thing to get people into a podcast, get people into a game. And so I guess broadly, how do you think about this idea of out-of-box play, or do you think of it that way?
Yeah, I think that's a really good word for it. I think so when I was making StarCrossed, which was my first RPG, I was really, I mean, it has a ton of inspirations in terms of its design, but I was definitely really inspired by Fall of Magic, which is a game that is played on this like big, beautiful scroll, and it comes with these like coins, and it's extremely elaborate. Like it's a very beautiful product, and it's a pleasure to hold and to engage with physically. And something that I noticed from playing with different people is that people who had never played an RPG before or thought that RPGs weren't for them, there was enough kind of magnetism just of those things, or some kind of magnetism to the game that drew people in. And that kind of that draw was enough to make people go, okay, well, I am intimidated by RPGs, or I had a bad experience when I was in high school, or I don't understand them or whatever. But this feels like, okay, wait, tell me more about this game, because this feels like something I could try. And my games are very much made for, you know, I want anyone to play them, but I actually especially want people who think that they don't like RPGs to play them. Those are like, oh, when I get those folks at the table, I just, oh, it's so satisfying to me. So being very like inspired by that game, it was interesting because I was like, well, this is not like a super simple, like, you know, it's not like For the Queen or lots of other card-based games where you just draw the first card and go, but there's something about the entire experience being contained in a box. It comes out and you can just start playing as soon as you kind of see it, right? Like you're engaged with the game as soon as you see it, rather than it being kind of hidden away in enormous books. So yeah, I mean, that's come out in lots of different ways in my games, but I think there's something that makes, when the game is just all there and it's all contained, that really kind of creates a nice little slip and slide into play that, again, makes it accessible to lots of people, but especially people who don't usually play games. And those are the people I want to play with.
There is something really great there about, like, if you've never played a TTRPG before and you're a little nervous about it, it is all, like, locked up in a book. And when you think of game, no one thinks of book. They think of Scrabble. They think of the box. And the second you give them something to latch onto that is a little bit familiar, it makes it so much easier to make that hurdle of I open up the box and there's a book inside, but at least I've had the box experience. Like now I yes. kind of know what's going on.
Yeah, totally. And the first printing of Starcrossed actually had like a whole Jenga tower in it. And we have not done that in subsequent printings because the boys at Bully Pulpit Games are very sensible and they're like, it doesn't make any, it makes it so much more expensive. Like shipping is wild. People have Jenga towers, you know? So we haven't done it since, although there's still room in the box for your tower. But there was just something about that. And I talked to Ross, the designer of Fall of Magic, and he was like, if you tell people, hey, here you go, here's a game, you can play it, it's a very different experience than here's a game. At some point in the future, if you have unlocked its riddles and also acquired some writing implements and like this and that and some minis and you have to print these things out and like, you know, there's character sheets in the book that you can like photocopy, but like who does that? There's PDFs online, go over here. Because the thing is, I'm the kind of like obsessive nerd who will do that. Like, I will go to ridiculous lengths to play a game. And I know so many people for whom, like, reading the rule book is, like, half of the fun. They're like, well, maybe I'll get to the table, but I'm already having such a great time, like, you know, just rolling up characters myself or just reading lore or just imagining the game. Like, all of that stuff is really, really, really fun. But there is something about, like, no, we're just going to play now. Here's the game. Now we can play it. That it's nice.
I think that like a lot of this idea of like getting people who are not RPG people to play for me comes into this idea of like what can we learn from board games? Because like board games are the kind of thing that like people are used to being roped into by their friends. You know, there's still sometimes like a lot of memes about being taught board games or whatever. But we had a great conversation with Banana Chan, who is the designer of games like Jiangsha Blood in the Banquet Hall, about how Banana used to publish board games and has taken a lot of that like production thought and knowledge into designing such TTRPGs as Jiangsha. And I'm curious, like, on the one level, like, how does this change your like production challenges? And obviously you've worked with partners, but there's something that as a designer myself, I want to ask you where I was like, Starcross was your first game and it was in a box. Like, that seems like a huge endeavor. Like, what was that like?
Also, I just got to point out, I just got to highlight that one more time. Starcrossed was your first game.
Like, yeah, batting average 1,000 out the gate.
Great opening day.
Thank you. It was, I mean, we could get into like the sort of weird pressure I felt after that to like make something that good. And actually, I've made 1,000 like little mediocre games since then and ups and downs and whatever. But I mean, taking on that ridiculous of a production challenge, like two things. One, I am absurdly overconfident in this and many things. And I'm just like, I could do that. But also, and perhaps more importantly, I was working with Bully Pulpit Games, who are the guys who've made Fiasco, and they had just made Ghost Court, which is a very fun live action game about ghosts in small claims court. Kind of yeah. like Judge Judy of the undead. It's very, very fun. But that was the first boxed game that they had ever made. And I'd worked with them like on the admin side on the Kickstarter for that. So we'd kind of learned a lot of lessons there. And I was like, okay, well, like, why not do it this way? Like, why not just whatever? And the other thing was like, I really, and again, with also with help from Jason and Steve at BPG, bless them, really, really wanted the rules to be extremely short. Because here's the thing, like, I'm not that inspired by board games. Most of the time, I don't like board games. Like, there are very, very, very few exceptions. But I'm very inspired by LARP. And actually, a long time ago, me and Banana Chan were making the same kind of LARPs, which were things that could fit on, like, a couple of pieces of paper, didn't involve that much reading. You could kind of run them procedurally. So like instead of learning the game in advance and then sitting down and you kind of run it, like the game being more like a script that you go through, do this, then do this, and you play it as you go rather than reading it in advance. And like little short, sharp experiences that are like 2 to 4 hours and don't require a lot of setup and costuming and stuff. So they were called like freeform LARPs or scenario LARPs or whatever. So she and I were both kind of in that tradition and making games that way. And so, yeah, in the end, my thing has a tower, so it comes in a box. But I really, really wanted the rules to be as short as possible. But I also wanted to give people something substantial, which is also why it has scene cards in it and why it has the character sheets in the box. And I wanted pencils in there too. And we did not put pencils, which was very smart and a great choice. But like, I really just wanted to be able to say like, go play. Not because I like board games, majority of the time I do not, but because I love playing LARPs and also folk games. Like my family's from Newfoundland, which is like this tiny little island off the coast of northeastern Canada. It's very cold there. It's very dark for a lot of the year. They were kind of late to get everything like TV and the internet and stuff like that. So there's like a big emphasis in the culture that I'm kind of descended from on like storytelling, joking, playing card games, playing musical instruments, like that kind of shared entertainment's really, really fun because you're in these tiny communities. And once again, it's very cold outside and you might die if you leave the house. So like, so, you know, in my family, like if you can cook, that's cool. If you can't cook, play an instrument. If you can't play an instrument, be able to tell a joke. If you can't tell a joke, tell a good story. Like there's something to that. And so every, like, I feel like all my aunts and grandmothers and great aunts and great, great grandmothers would just play cards and would all, and there's something about, like, they wouldn't be like, hey, here's this new card game I found every week. Right. Let me explain it to you. Cause the gals at the card club are not putting up with that kind of nonsense. They're like, no, no, let's just play. And so I'm very used to like just set of cards on the table. Okay, now we're playing whatever it is. And so there's actually that kind of like immediacy that I really, really want. Like, okay, we're playing. Let's go.
I feel like that's such a great transition into For the Queen. Like, I like because I totally resonate with a family who is obsessed with just card games. Like, that is like what my family did all growing up. And like, there is something so magic about the idea of that you leave the deck of cards on the table and that like you and two, three family members can just sit down and you are playing a game in the amount of time it takes to open the box, you know? And I really love that like, you're like, no, board games aren't as much the inspiration. It's more things like this, because that is such the experience of For the Queen. And we had this exact experience with For the Queen when we were at Breakout Con in March. We were sitting down with our friends Ray and Felix from MythWorks, and we were going to try and play like a new OSR game somebody had picked up. And we started like making characters, whatever. And it was like, we really don't have the time for this, like to like get into these rules. And then Ray was like, oh, I've got For the Queen like in my bag, and then pulls it out with the same activation energy of pulling out a deck of cards. And then we were playing. It's like, so I don't have a question. I just think that's awesome.
I just think it's neat. Thank you. Thank you. That really is like what I'm going for. And that is, and For the Queen also very much inspired by other games. Like in the same way that StarCrossed obviously took a lot from Fall of Magic and other kind of boxed RPGs. Obviously it took a ton from Dread, right? The Jenga-based horror game. And then went, oh, I'm hearing from people that they've never actually played Dread because they're like, oh, I need to get a tower. And it just comes in this like book. So I was like, just taking that on. I was like, oh, I don't want people to just get my game. I want them to play it. I want them to play it all the time. And then with For the Queen, like, you know, still inspired by all of that. And then also very much by a solo RPG called The Beast, which is a very old, very early journaling RPG where slightly different setup. And it's about this creature that you find and you like bring it home and you have this relationship with it. And you kind of shuffle up a bunch of cards. You play it over 30 days. But the thing is, as soon as you pull that top card, you know what to do with the rest of the deck. Right? Like it just, you just pick up and play. And so even though it takes 30 days, it does, again, doesn't have that like pre-game learning phase, right? It teaches right. You by playing it. And there was also, again, a lot of live action games that are actually structured like this. I think there are lots of people who play board games and TTRPGs who pick up For the Queen and they're like, oh my gosh, this is so like innovative. This is such a cool new format. No, it's not. It's not. I stole it. There's 183 Days by Noah Williamson and James Stewart that is like about two clairvoyants in love, and they know that they're going to meet and fall in love, and they know that their relationship will end. And you you know, play out the relationship between them. And so that's a game where you pull the first card and you know what to do with the next one. And then eventually you split it into two decks and then you each have your own, you know, thing. And so I play that. That's a phenomenal game. And something I absolutely love is Jason Morningstar's Juggernaut, which is a live action game about a computer that can tell the future, funny enough. And it takes place in the early 50s, and it's lots of interesting historical dynamics. But basically the game is a deck of cards. The first couple of cards are telling you the rules. And then the last part of the deck is a bunch of predictions that Juggernaut might make. And so you shuffle up those cards and put them there. So that produces this really, really useful pacing device where you're playing your characters. Your character sheet is, again, also just a poker-sized card. And whenever there's like a lull, whenever something isn't happening, then any player can go, oh, Juggernaut has just printed out another prediction. You go and grab the card and read it out loud and then respond to that. So it means that there's always something to work with. It's just really, really helpful when you're like LARPing because, you know, there's no director to like to control the flow of the scene, right? It's up to everyone. And so that makes Juggernaut such a great first time live action game for people. And I've actually handed it to people at multiple conventions when people are like, oh, I want to LARP. And I'm like, great, here you go. Like, just take this, go over there. I will tape off a corner of the room for you. I've done this at Gen Con. I did it at the first PAX Unplugged. And people can just, again, draw the first card and start playing. So to me, that is like the ultimate of this, like, yeah, let's just play feeling. And again, when I saw how kind of approachable that made LARPing for people, then yeah, I'm like, well, of course. Or, you know, solo RPGing, whatever it is. So that was very exciting to me. Although I will say, For the Queen did not start there at all. The first playtest of For the Queen had a Jenga tower and I think at least 40 dice on the table.
Whoa. Very different game.
Yeah. I really just kind of like woke up one day and was like, oh, I've got a great idea. And then play tested it like 2 days later with some friends of mine. And at the end of that play test was like, oh, perfect. Great. Yeah. These dice and tower have no function and they just slow the game down. This is just a bunch of cards. So it's not like I set out to make that format, but because I'd played games like Juggernaut and like The Beast before, that allowed me to go, oh, if this is just a deck of cards, like that's fine, that can exist. Like that works and makes sense.
It was a really great experience for me the first time we did For the Queen, because I love board games and I have a bugbear about people explaining rules, because I think a lot of people do it wrong. They start talking about like, here's all the stuff and the strategy. And I'm like, can you tell me what I'm supposed to do first? Like, what's the goal of the game? And I remember we sat down to play For the Queen and Ray pulled it out. And I was kind of like, oh, so how do we play? And everyone was just like, no, like we'll draw the first card and that'll explain it. And there was a part of me inside that was like, no, tell me how to play first.
don't trick me.
Right. I've been here before. I know this isn't going to work. But then like we all passed around and like started, not only were we learning the rules as we were going, but we were actively performing the ritual of playing in a way that like, great, now I have it. I'm doing
yes.
it.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Because that's the sort of tutorialization, right? That,
yeah,
that I think is a goal for a lot of designers, is that you should be able to learn by playing. And so in a lot of games, like, you know, a lot of like, say, traditional card games, that often looks like doing a practice round, right? Like, well, let's just play a practice round. And then the person who knows how to play plays with the person who doesn't. And there's a little more explanation. And we say it doesn't count. We don't count the points from the first two practice rounds. And then we play. So in For the Queen, the idea is that that the rules are a practice round, because you're practicing reading a card out loud in front of people, which can actually be quite difficult for some people. And it you have to practice waiting your turn, signaling the end of your turn to other people, right? Usually through fairly subtle social cues, or sometimes by just like placing the card down. And you have to practice listening to each other, asking each other follow-up questions, maybe, And getting into the momentum of doing those things, right? Like, yes, the cards do literally tell you, like, pick up cards and ask questions and you know, explain the scant rules and the lore. But it's actually by practicing that you do it. Like, oh, when it's my turn, everyone listens to me. When it's someone else's turn, I listen to them. We pay close attention to each other and we build off of that. And we're building on each other's ideas, right? Like, in the rules, you're literally, like, not one of you is explaining a whole section yourself, right? You're building an explanation together. So yes, thank you so much. Thank you so much for noticing that. Like, yeah, it's telling you the rules, but you're just actually practicing.
It was a great moment because it was also, you know, Ellie and I are both game designers. And when I experienced that, I was like, oh, that's the, I got to do that. Like, I got to do, people, we can talk all we want about, like tutorialization. But the second you experience it, you're like, oh, that's the thing.
I feel like there's a, like, we talked to Jay Dragon recently about Yazebas and how Jay was saying this idea of, like, you can tell when a designer has played or read Yazebas because, like, they get, like, Yazeba pilled in their future designs and start using things from it. And I feel very much the same way about For the Queen. And I think that that's, like, the case for so many, like, modern designers I love. Like, so many people cite For the Queen as, like, you know, an inspiration for the way that they, like, do rules or, like, create the magic circle or, like, what have you. And, like, I guess the question I have here is, like, what has it been like to watch the effect of For the Queen, not only on players, but also, like, your fellow designers?
Oh, gratifying. So gratifying. And I would say in particular, talking to people who made their first game because of For the Queen. Like, that's something that really, really matters to me. Like, people who are already designing games, you know, having this new perspective or this new inspiration, or that's super cool. But I have talked to people who were like, oh, it made me go, oh, I could do that. Like, I could make a game. And that is so, so, so important and meaningful to me that, you know, that someone gets to participate in this thing that I love. I mean, if you love games, especially, I think, board games and TTRPGs, you just want people to come and do the fun thing that you like. You know, that's the dream. You're just like, come on, folks, like, come have this fun that I love so much. And so getting to do that for game design, right, which is also to me like a fun game of its own, right, that felt really special. And again, especially because a lot of those people who talked to me about, who were like, yeah, I'm going to make a game because of For the Queen, they're going to make my first game. A lot of those folks were like, were women and were people with like unrelatedly, like just quiet voices or people who don't speak up a lot in a social situation or people who, you know, are like the under contributors rather than the over contributors at a game table. And the idea of like women, especially kind of finding their voices and like asserting themselves through game design. I'm like, oh yes, how can I do more of that? Cause game design like just goes against so many things that people who are socialized female get socialized to do, right? Because it's literally telling people what to do. Like game design is ordering people around. Game design is being bossy. And so is GMing. And you know, being bossy in a benevolent and helpful and beautiful, fun way, but still. So yeah, to me, inspiring first-time designers is like, mwah, that's the chef's kiss.
The twinkle in your eye when you said, but still, is the only time on this podcast I've ever wanted it to be a video podcast.
There's something I want to pull out of what you said there, which I loved, of like when you are a games person, all you want to do is like get people to be like, come do the fun thing with me. Like, I love this. And I'm gonna pull in a like personal experience here because I think it's relevant. I recently tabled at a convention for the first time, and it was not a games convention. It was an art festival. And the way I was pitching people is they would walk by, I would catch their eye, and I would say, do you like games? And the amount of adults who looked me in the eyes and said no was so sad to me. Like, it was such a bummer. And like, I guess the question I have is like, one of the big goals for you with this game is like getting those people who aren't games people to try it. And like, how do you, what is the way you approach someone like that to say like, hey, give this a shot?
So I think my response to like, do you like games? No. is bullshit. Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. You know, because I really think that everyone has this playful capacity, and most people play some kind of game at some point, even if all they do is like play with a kid, or all they do is play backgammon on their phone. Or, you know, my grandmother took up bridge very late in life. When she was like in her 70s, she was like, you got to learn new things, Alexander. You got to keep the mind sharp. So like everyone I know plays some kind of game. And if they truly do not play, they don't care about games at all, then there is some kind of playful capacity that has just not been reached yet. But people say that when they're like, yeah, I'm not really like a games person. I wonder how much of that has to do with like what they think of as a game and what gets associated with games and what gets associated with like games culture. Like they're like, I'm not a games person because I have an idea in my head about what that person is and looks like and does. And I'm not that, whether in a self-defeating or self-aggrandizing way, I don't know. But like, there's like a culture associated with games. And so, yeah, if the only games you've ever played are like, or that have ever been presented to you are either sort of, yeah, Scrabble or Monopoly, or are like super complex role-playing games, or are like a Cards Against Humanity thing, then there's lots of reasons why people could bounce off of that. But people have a creative capacity. And if they're like, oh, I don't like art and I don't do art, I'm not creative, right? Then again, that tells me like, okay, so you've never been presented and encouraged with like an art form that works for you. Everyone has that capacity. So it's just like, you know, again, you never want to like force things on people or be like, well, you're going to like my game. But I am more curious about how that person plays, what opportunities that person has to play. What kind of games did they used to like? Because they probably did like some game at some point. So I want to show curiosity about that.
Rom-Com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about meet-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-Com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom. Or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Don't look under the bed. Don't open the closet. And whatever you do, don't skip this ad. World Champ Game Co. is the one-stop shop for all of your horror desires this Halloween season. Sink your teeth into classic thrills with slasher card game 1978, The Night They Came Home. Keep close to the light as you weave eerie new tales with Campfire, anthology horror storytelling. Whatever makes your spine crawl, World Champ has a game for you. Run for your life to worldchamp.io and grab your next favorite horror role-playing game. And right now, get 20% off your order with code KILLER. Again, that's 20% off at worldchamp.io with code KILLER. And when you can't fall asleep at night, just keep telling yourself, it's only a game.
The Between is now crowdfunding on BackerKit. The Between is a new role-playing game from the creators of the award-winning Brindlewood Bay. Inspired by Penny Dreadful and Sherlock Holmes, you play as monster hunters in Victoria-era London, investigating and neutralizing these supernatural threats that terrorize the city. Threats that Scotland Yard can't or won't handle themselves. As the story progresses, you become aware of a criminal mastermind pulling the strings behind the scenes. In the end, you will have to face this mastermind in order to save both Queen and country. Rewards for backing this project include the Between's core rulebook, Shadow Society, an expansion book for the game's London setting, and Sons of Another World, which gives you three brand new settings for the Between. And back early to get access to a limited reward, the glow-in-the-dark Mastermind Dice. So head right now to BackerKit and search The Between.
I do think a lot of that culture of people saying I'm not into games is a casualty of a whole generation of people playing Monopoly wrong and being mad about it. Everyone homebrewed Monopoly in a way that was never better than what the real rules are, and now everyone doesn't like games because of it. I think we can blame Parker Brothers.
I mean, truly, like, I actually do think that in the 20th century, the richness and fullness of games was like reduced to a few very successful products. And those successful products are not necessarily fun games at all. Like, I remember being forced to play Monopoly, having to play Risk. Man, playing Risk if you don't want to play Risk.
Sucks.
Torment. So again, yeah, it's like, what do people have access to, you know, when they're like, oh, I don't like games. Is it because you played like a really frustratingly hard NES game in like 1992 and you're like, oh, I'm out.
I do remember like a year and a half ago or something, I watched an episode of the show Killing Eve, and in the show they were playing Dixit and called it out by name. And I was truly like blown away. Delightful. I was like, what? Yeah. This is a whole new chapter of games.
Yeah.
That's great.
I would have been thrilled if they picked up Catan, but Dixit? That's a whole other right? step down.
Yeah.
And I think it like also connects to like one of the things that's so great about what you were saying before is that not only are you taking non-games people and making them games people, like in a lot of cases, you're maybe taking non-games people and making them games designers. Like you said, like women and other like marginalized identities who are like, I never considered that I could do this sort of thing. But like the act of playing it not only unlocked the play in them, but unlocked the designer brain. And like that's such a great like little piece of magic, you know, to be able to do for someone.
Thank you. Yeah. I think like a lot of the joy of making role-playing games specifically is connecting people to their creativity when people are often profoundly alienated from their creativity for lots of different reasons and in lots of different ways. And so like that's to me is the pleasure of giving people an opportunity to play is that they get to find out that, oh, actually I'm very creative. Actually, I can come up with stuff that is fun and interesting and entertaining to people, and I can do it with other people. I can collaborate. That is a great, great pleasure. And so then, yeah, when that is also able to expand people's self-concept, right, of, oh, I can be someone who is creative. I can be someone who plays. I can be someone who makes games for others to play. Like, that's the catnip for me.
I do also really love seeing, because I had only played For the Queen for the first time relatively recently, you know, a couple of months ago. But I had pretty much every game designer we had talked to on this show or in general, For the Queen seemed to be like your favorite game designer's favorite game. And it was in this kind of like cult air to me. It's really cool to see that game now, like to be able to play it and then like a month later have it be re-released. And now there's like this whole other group of people discovering it. I'm excited to see what other games come out just because, hey, there's a revitalization of this game that was already everybody's favorite. And now there's a whole new group of people who are going to be able to see it. I'm really excited about that.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm interested in that as well. And like, what kind of new audience is it? Like, you know, I know it's, I mean, again, just to have it available and on the shelves again is like, thank goodness. I'm so glad. But it also, yeah, is accessible to a different and wider set of people. It's, you know, going to be easier to get like internationally, like outside the US. I mean, so internationally as in like the country where I live, in such far off lands as here. But like, yeah, so I don't know exactly what that will look like. And I don't know exactly what that will produce or is producing. And I don't know. We'll see.
So I think kind of coming, like shifting gears a little bit to this second edition of For the Queen, I feel like a second edition is one of those things that speaks to sustainability of both like your career as a designer and also just like game design as an industry. And I kind of want to see, like, I want to ask sort of what has this process of doing a second edition like said to you about like your own sustainability as a game designer? Like, I know you mentioned some stuff about like post Starcrossed being like really like pressure filled, but then like when something has this like revitalization, like what does that do for you in terms of like your career and state as a game designer?
Oh man, that's a very good and very complex question. For me, doing a second edition of For the Queen, it didn't initiate a lot of work because so much of what's new in this game, right? New prompts that I wrote and slight rules tweaks and lore tweaks are just things that I've wanted to do for a while. You know, I've continued to play this game, to run it at conventions and, you know, run it for different people. And so many times I've been like, oh, you know, it would be really great. Or, you know what I should do. And generally speaking, like I've played the first edition a lot. And so when I would play with friends, I just kind of have my own set of cards anyway, right? Because this game started out as a handwritten pile of index cards, and so did the second edition, right? I just started writing out cards and playing them with friends. So it didn't like initiate, oh, now I got to write a second edition. It was more like, okay, now I can put these cards somewhere and they are actually going to go in it, and I can, you know, make all the little tweaks I would like to make. But thinking about, yeah, like there's a second edition of this game and what does that mean? And just put out a supplement for Starcrossed and what does that mean? And there's like, I don't know if I can be a little vulnerable. Like there's this weird mix of, wow, this is great. Like something that I made kind of has like enduring popularity or enduring interest to people. People are still interested in it. They're not just like, oh yeah, that was the game that was kind of hot for like a couple months and everyone played it. Now everyone's kind of done. They moved on to the next thing. Like, that's exciting to me. That's interesting. And then also I'm like, I think a tiny, tiny little bit like afraid that, oh, am I just going to keep making like new additions and expansions to things I've already made? Am I like past my prime as a designer? Like, am I out of new stuff or new ideas? But I don't know. It doesn't keep me up at night.
We spoke with Kieran Gillen not too long ago about the upcoming Die scenarios, which is like the expansions to Die. And I think there is something really important though about like nurturing the work that you've already made and like continuing to foster that community. Because if you don't do a second edition, if you don't do Starcrossed Love Letters, if you don't continue to like expand and tend to these works, they could kind of wither on the vine. But doing the work of continuing to like uplift them is what makes people so like continually excited to play them. I feel like we've had the same conversation about our actual play podcast, My First Dungeon, about we keep making new and new stuff, but then there's a part of us that almost forgets sometimes that like the stuff we made 6 months ago is still really good. And if we don't tend to it and care for it, it will just kind of fade off into the distance. And we don't want it to because we're really proud of it.
Yeah. And I think there's also like when you make art, there's a real desire that I often have to be like, I never want to look at this ever again. Like it's done. Don't trouble me with it. I'm done. And with games, it's different because it's not like it's not like you've just painted the painting and then it's out there and you can kind of like people are still playing it. People are still making stuff with it. They're still engaging with it. And, it's funny. I think like, the new For the Queen is really like about like expanding the game and bringing it to new people and seeing where that goes. And honestly, like fingers crossed, let them make me make like sequels and booster packs and adaptations. And like, cause I actually, it is such a fun format to write for, like to just write out question cards and stuff. Like I do want to do that. And I, again, think about like, who could that reach? And, you know, what could different people be doing with this in different contexts? As where like Starcrossed Love Letters actually really does feel like for the fans, like for people who love Starcrossed. I think like, you know, obviously that also puts in front of new eyes and, you know, is like a bit revitalizing to the game. But my actual real like heart's intention for that game is for the people who have been playing Starcrossed since it came out or since I started playtesting it in whatever, like 2015, 2016. So like, that's really for that because I think also like, I have so much gratitude for the people who play my games. And I think anyone who makes games must feel this way in some way that like, I can make whatever I want, but if people don't play it, it's kind of like, well, what's the point? Or like, is it really done? Right. We get into that. And so I and maybe especially Starcross, you know, like it's like my first game and it came out at a very different time. And, you know, I've really encountered people who are like, well, why would you want to make a game like that? Or why would you, or that's not really a role-playing game or whatever. So I feel very affectionate towards it and a little bit protective. And when I've seen people enjoy it, it's a game that produces so many like giggles and blushes and, you know, hands going up to people's faces like this and tears sometimes. And so like, I don't know, it requires vulnerability. My players give me that. And I just want to reward them. I just want to give them nice things and fun things to play with.
Can I tell you about my first experience playing StarCrossed?
Please. Yes, please.
So I had been wanting to play StarCrossed ever since someone told me the tagline of a game for two people who really, really want to, but really, really can't, which I have to give you all the flowers in the world of like, that is the most effective tagline of anything I've ever heard. Didn't know what the game was. Someone told me that. And I was like, I have to learn everything about this game and buy it immediately. And we played it as a Patreon bonus thing for our other podcast, My First Dungeon. And it was me and my good friend Shenouk sitting across from each other at a very small table. We had the Jenga tower set up, microphones set up. And I knew what this game was. It was, you know, two people falling. It was, you know, one one-on-one role-playing game. Shenouk and I are very close. He was in my wedding. My wife was like in the other room. And there was a moment where we clicked on the recorder and I did the introduction, like, hello, welcome to My First Dungeon, yada, yada, yada. We're going to be playing StarCross today. And then at some point, I kind of looked up from my computer and looked right at Shenouk and I was like, oh, this is the most intimate I've ever been with this person.
Yes, like, yes.
Like right away. I think you even hear it in my voice. I literally go from like my presenter voice, like, oh, hi. Sir. And then we ended up telling like a very fun and like progressively more and more intimate story and had a really nice, and I remember like turning off the recorder and us both kind of just like sitting across from each other for a minute, just being like, ah, it was just like, ah, it was lovely. Oh. And there was also a part of both of us where we're like, Abby's in the other room. We can't do anything right now.
We're being chaperoned.
There's something like, to be a little sentimental, there is something like really beautiful about unlocking that kind of intimacy, especially for like two male friends. Like,
oh,
it's like,
God,
such
yes.
a like hard thing.
Oh my God.
You know, like in life broadly. Not like, I'd say that like you and Shenouk are two of the more sensitive, you know, men I know in my life, but like still, it's like you don't often get that just like permission to sit there and do that.
It is also a moment of like, in my head, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm a sensitive man. And I think of Shenouk as being a very sensitive man. But until you're actually put into the situation of like confronting that, you're like, oh, now I've got to actually like kind of put my money where my mouth is and be open with this person in a way that is not traditional for my upbringing.
Yeah, that is not normally associated with your social role, right? This is another beautiful thing about role-playing games is that they don't just, they give permission, right? They give what we call an alibi for different behaviors, different ideas, different like kinds of expression, but also ideally should facilitate that, right? Like there's a lot of things in StarCross that are there because they facilitate that. Like obviously the tower represents this increasingly shaky thing and it produces tension. It's also a third object that the two people kind of triangulate with. It's something to look at instead of the other person, which allows you to like kind of moderate the intensity of what you're doing. The way that the scene cards, it's very like, there's a reason they're scene cards and not just a list of scenes on a piece of paper. Like the scene cards are really important because they're a pacing device. They allow you to like take a breath before you move on to the next scene. So there's lots of things that I've put in there to like scaffold intimacy because yeah, I think like, I mean, certainly, especially for some people, we could get into that. But there's not a lot of, or there tend to be very specific ways, right, that people are allowed to be intimate with each other and very specific relationships in which intimacy is kind of permitted to take place, I think, especially for men. And so, like, not just saying, hey, it's okay, but giving people tools to have that kind of connection with each other, like, that is truly my ideal outcome. That feels amazing.
There was also another part of the rules of StarCross that I don't think I read the rules like right before we started recording or like really like dove back into it and make sure we were ready to play. And there was a rule that as I was reading it, I didn't think was going to be a thing that I cared about as much. And it was the, you can only talk in character when you're pulling the block.
Yes.
It, in my head, I was like, me and him are performers. We perform together all the time on actual play. Like, we don't need that limitation. Like, we'll do it because it's the rules. When we got into it, I was like, oh, no, I actually kind of need this permission and crutch moment, because I'm like, I was expecting to go into this game feeling very comfortable, and I was like starting to feel uncomfortable in moments, and I was like, ooh, this is actually a great, it is another great moment of permission of like, this is the time you get to do this, and then it's also, this is the time when you get to step away from that type of intimacy or emotion.
Yeah, and it sets up a pacing that I think is really, really important. So before that rule existed and I was playtesting, I was watching players just kind of have casual chats with each other, and chatting, like small talk, is one of the ways that we diffuse tension between people, right? Is just to have a chat. And so I was watching that and I was like, no, this cannot be allowed to continue. This is awful. Look at them dispelling the tension and becoming comfortable. Oh, this is intolerable. And so it's very, very much LARP inspired. Like, you know, in order to speak in character, you have to do something, or you have to sort of express intimacy through a third object. And so, yeah, that's where the touching the tower thing comes from. And I've never heard it described that way, as like something that is supportive and that gives you permission to just talk now. This is your talking time, because it's really more designed to make you uncomfortable. It's more designed to make you be very parsimonious with what you say, and to do the thing that inevitably happens when you have a big crush on someone, which is that every word you say feels like a risk. Like, what will happen if I say this or that? You know, if you've ever seen someone draft and redraft a text to someone like 10 times and then they like show their friends. I kind of wanted that a little bit. And so, yeah, thank you. It's a very, very beautiful way of describing it.
I think, just to like put a cap on my thought there, I think the reason I found it so supportive was that it made something that was scary for an hour and a half very tolerable for like the 10 seconds. So it's like, you only have to be in this space for the time it takes you to pull it out. And that, like, you immediately, as you start doing it, you know where that ending is, and you can do it in much smaller chunks in a way that when you step back and look at the entire game, you did it a lot. When you step back or in the moment, it's like, I only have to do this for 10 seconds. If I can do that and be comfortable in that, great. And then you can like reamp yourself up for it the next time.
Oh my God. That's so true. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. That's very observant.
You're welcome. It was very fun. I had a great time. We played a magician and their assistant, and it was like this, you know, will they, won't they?
Oh my gosh. Thank you.
We also had an ending that was like, I want to like write it. It was great. So good.
This is the thing. This is the treat that I get to enjoy from StarCrossed, and to a lesser extent For the Queen. Like, For the Queen is such a specific setup that it's more like hearing about different stagings of a play, right? Because it's like these slight modifications on the same thing. Like, oh, our queen ended up being really this or really that. And like, we were kind of in this world or that world. And so you can hear like different ways that like a classic play would be staged, right? As we're with StarCrossed, people tell me this like custom, this completely original love story. And it's, yeah, magician and their assistant, or it's like the people played the pet dogs of two ex-lovers who would meet at the dog park, but obviously like their owners didn't want to interact. And so they just had this like very limited time at the dog park.
I love
right?
that.
So like,
that's so good.
And that's the thing, is that means when people tell me about their game, they're not just like, oh, I had a really nice time, which is obviously very gratifying for my ego. I also get to hear a little love story. Like, what a pleasure. Mm. What a delight.
Oh man. So good. Sorry, I'm just like, I'm feeling very good. I love games. I love your games. It's just, this is very, very joyful, like little tidbits for throughout. I want to ask you sort of a maybe like a on the spot game design sort of thought experiment. It, specifically related to For the Queen, you said you wrote some new questions in this new edition that people who like know and love the game might not have known is in this new thing. I want to ask you, like, what makes a good question in TTRPGs by your measure?
Okay.
Or a successful question.
Yes.
Not good.
Yes, absolutely. So I did like a whole presentation about this a long time ago. You can track it down on YouTube somewhere, where I talk about prompt-based game design. or question-based game design. And I think a really good For the Queen or Descended from the Queen, you know, question kind of has two components. It needs to both give the player something and ask something of them, like ask them to make something up, but also kind of give them a container to put it in. And so, for example, saying, what does your character do at the royal court? I think is a lot harder to answer than, you know, your character does something at the royal court that makes them an unlikely choice for this journey. What is it? Right? So you're kind of at least giving people a shape of something to put their answer in, right? They can see the, you know, the outline of it. And then what can be really, really fun is giving people something like that and then asking them something that kind of contradicts it. So one of the questions like, you think you might be the queen's favorite. Why does this make you uneasy? Right? So you introduce something, but then say, why is this good thing not good? Or why is this bad thing good? Or whatever. And I would say this is especially for the Queen, which is about like contradictions, about like feeling conflicted about something and getting conflicted information and conflicting stories. So it's good to kind of discombobble like that. But I think anything that you were writing about, right? If you were, you know, if you were making a Descended from the Queen game about a garden, for example, I think it would be not, I think it would be very challenging to ask like, what's growing in your garden? Did your roses do well last year or not? Right? Like either a yes or no answer or a completely open answer, I think can be difficult for either difficult or not fruitful, right? If you just say, did your roses grow last year? Then the answer can just be yes or no. And I think most players would probably elaborate on it, but they're not really being invited to. As where then the question, you know, what's growing in your garden is like so open that I think people can get kind of frozen. So then having a question like, your roses grew really well last year. Why are you afraid that won't happen this year? That gives you something that is like, okay, something I know and I can build on, but also something that makes me go like, oh, well, why would I like, you know, that still asks you something ambiguous or asks you to engage with it. And that's also a fun way as a designer to play the game with the players, right? Because you are introducing lore, you are introducing ideas or saying that things happened in the world and in the game. So again, if we're in this garden thing, it's like, you know, you had an infestation of weevils last year, or you suddenly have an infestation of weevils. What makes you hesitant to do anything about it? Like, I don't know. So yeah, you can kind of seed things. But yeah, generally speaking, I think if you're asking questions, and I think probably in a lot of other contexts too, right? Like if you're GMing and you can say to the players, like, you know this NPC from when you were in college, what was your relationship like? Right? Like to give them something specific and then ask them to elaborate on it, I think that's what makes people feel both supported in the sense of having something there, but also supported as in, okay, now it's your turn and you get to jump off of that. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. So Alex, you talked about how, you know, it's wonderful to support these two games and like give that back to the players that have given so much to you. But there's some like fear of like, will I get to make something new that matters? And like, and I want to just like kind of go at that a little bit and be like, what is exciting to you right now about like, do you have new ideas you're interested in exploring? Is there a kind of game you want to make? Like, what are your sort of hopes for what that new thing could be or just a new area you want to play around in as a designer?
I kind of have three answers to this. One is that I did make a playable, sort of playtestable version of basically Kagematsu, but your robots in space, and got to playtest it recently. And it went pretty well in a way that makes me go, yeah, that was fun. I don't know if I'll do anything else with it or not. So that's like my ambiguous answer. But the other thing is, instead of game design, in the last kind of year or so, I've really, really gotten into collage. I'm doing a lot of collage, like just finding scraps of paper and putting them together and seeing what happens. And I'm really just like loving it right now. And I'm not sharing it anywhere. Like it's here in my house. But that's making me go like, is there a collage-based TTRPG? Like, is there a way to get people to share a story or collaborate on a story or characters through the medium of tearing stuff up and sticking it to paper? Yeah, that could be something, but we'll see. But honestly, like the real answer is I think maybe it's time for me to like collaborate more. One of the reasons why this new edition is coming out is because Darrington hired me recently to do some work on their game, Till the Last Gasp, which is the initial design was by Will Hindmarch. And so I was kind of called into punch up or to finish or to dot some I's and cross some T's. And it was so fun. I just couldn't believe how fun it was to take something that was, Will's brilliant. So it was just already this really solid foundation and this thing that worked. And then to just get to put little curly cues on it and just add this sort of sparkle and fun and to write a lot of random tables. That turns out that is my, as intoxicating to me. I love to just make stuff up. After that, obviously Love Letters and Second Edition took up a lot of my sort of games time. But I think collaborating and writing with other people or working on an existing game, I think is actually quite nourishing for me right now. I'm doing a piece about intimacy in games for a collection called How to GM Romance. So there's a book that's coming out that's kind of advicey. So I'm writing for that. And I'm working on a little something for the Shift RPG, which is a kind of a setting neutral, but very much fantasy inclined, tabletop GM'd RPG. So I'm writing something for them. So that's my other two answers are sort of vague tidbits of, ooh, but this is no, actually I think what I need to do is not my own thing for a little bit. I'd rather work with other people.
Love that. The last question I had for you is Starcrossed and For the Queen both came out in 2019. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Both came out in 2019. It's now 2024. Second edition of both of those things is kind of coming out in the Starcrossed Love Letters and Second Edition For the Queen. What have you seen in the past 5 years of how the industry has changed from when you first launched these games to when you are making these new iterations now?
It's a great question. I think the two things that come to mind immediately are expansion, just such a bigger TTRPG world and industry than I could have ever imagined when I got into this biz. There was a time when I really felt like I knew everyone in the world who was playing or who was making indie role-playing games. And now I'm absolutely not. And of course, I never did, because a lot of that kind of growth and expansion has actually been role-playing game communities in different parts of the world discovering each other. And so it's a much more internationally connected world than it's ever been. So that's very exciting. So it's a bigger and more diverse world. So that obviously just produces these just infinite things, right? That I could never have predicted in whatever 2016. But the other thing is that its relationship to the internet has changed a lot. Obviously, Roll20 has been around for a long time. And now there's really an assumption that if you're making a game, unless you have some compelling reason not to, it should work online. And more people are playing with online as a design surface. So one of the things in Love Letters is, here are the official rules for how to play StarCrossed online, which is actually just other people figured it out, and then we hired them to write it down for us.
Perfect.
Which is great. Yeah. So those things are kind of fascinating, and I don't really know what to do with them. They're just ooh. But I will say there's been such a huge interest in the last few years in solo RPGs. I made a tiny little solo game called Precious Little Animal in, 2021. And it was very gratifying to play with, and it was very gratifying to hear about, that people had these sort of lovely private creative experiences, which is why there's a solo version of StarCrossed also in Love Letters. So I'm very interested in the solo RPG space, and I'm just kind of luxuriating in and waiting to see more what happens from that expansion of the space, including onto the internet.
It is really cool to see every TTRPG I see kickstarting or on BackerKit, somewhere in the first five comments is the question, are there solo rules for this game?
Yeah, right?
It's even if you'd asked me a year ago, I wouldn't have expected that to have been a thing. And it's just more and more coming up that people want to have that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And at one time I would have said what's the whole point of this is to play with other people and to play face to face. Why would these two things, But now I'm oh yeah, of course. It's these are wonderful things. These are super exciting and inspiring things. So yeah, it's been interesting to see. And the nice thing too about that is that means I'm not even going to try to guess like where RPGs are going in the next 5 years, because I certainly could not have predicted the last 5 years. I know that.
Who could? So, Alex, our closing question that we love to ask every one of our guests is what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking for a recommendation to our listeners that you have. This could be a person, a resource, a book, a game. It can be tabletop related, or it can just be something you dig in the world right now.
Okay, so I will say I recently got to play two games by Julia Bond Ellingbow, who's an incredibly influential designer who's kind of left the space and is pursuing mostly other stuff. And so I recently got to play her game Steal Away Jordan, which is about being enslaved people in the antebellum South, and her game Tales of the Fisherman's Wife, which is kind of a Japanese fantasy game where 2 to 4 people play, and you play the fisherman who goes out to sea and his wife who stays at home, and both of them have kind of secret relationships with little spirits and monsters called obake that live nearby. And these are games that inspired me so much just knowing that they existed, because these games came out like, I think Steal Away Jordan was like 2007, right? So these games were really inspiring to me, even though I had never played them. They just expanded my idea of what games could be about. And so I finally got to play them, and like, these things still exist. They're in PDF. So go check out the work of Julia Bond Ellingbow and play some games that are partially responsible for the games that you love today.
Hell yeah. We'll put all those links in the show notes below. You can go check them out. Thank you so much, Alex, for coming to the table. Do you want to let the people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you?
Yeah, absolutely. If you just go to helloalexroberts.card.co, that's where all my links are to my stuff. I've got a little newsletter on there if you want to very occasionally hear from me about exciting things. I'm on Patreon now, and I'm kind of trying to do more with that. Patreon.com/HelloAlexRoberts. Trying to be less on social media these days, so like you could find me on Twitter and Blue Sky and stuff, but it's not going to be much there. Come on my Patreon, and I'm going to start, blogging about things that I'm amused by and so on.
And if you want more gaming content from us, please check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord, where you can come and chat about this fantastic conversation. Those are both linked in our show notes. Please rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.